to some extent inspired by a lifelong friendship for Timaru's president and Nobel laureate Ramos Horta, we took the program to East Timor almost 10 years ago. Did a lot of programs from the country, the world's newest country struggling to establish itself, met some wonderful people and watched their struggles in close-up. Our next guest has spent even more time in East Timor. It was back in 1991 when he was working as the Vicar General in Melbourne that a group of East Timorese asked him to arrange a commemorative mass to mark 16 years since the 1975 invasion by Indonesia. He looked into it, decided he would. Before the mass took place, over 250 East Timorese were killed by the Indonesian military in the Santa Cruz Cemetery, an absolute atrocity, and others were killed in their hospital beds later. And yes, East Timor was all over the news again. The tragedy forged a bond between Bishop Deacon and the East Timorese community, both here in Australia and in East Timor. Bishop Deacon embraced the opportunity to support the East Timorese and believed he'd been preparing for this role his whole life. Now, to fill us in on his experiences and explain his passion for East Timor, Bishop Hilton Deacon joins us from our Melbourne studio. Blessings upon you, Bishop.
Thank you, Philip, very much.
Let's begin by discussing how you were radicalised. I believe it took place in the Riverina.
My mother assures me, and assured me very ardently, that I had been conceived in the Riverina, but then born in Seymour, where she had an aunt who was a nurse. In those days, nurses were rather different from what they are today. And I was born there, but I had an older brother who was there, and he eventually died. He was three. And then went back to New South Wales, to the Riverina.
Now, Hilton, as I understand it, your mum was generous with the unemployed in the area, and you used to play with the black kids in town, and so you got an early understanding of workers' struggles.
I believe I did, Philip. It was in the days of the terrible depression in the late 1930s, or the early 1930s rather, and somebody would come to their little cottage that we lived in. It was a very primitive place, and she would give them a billy full of soup or stew or something. Now, that might happen in a year half a dozen times, but it was enough to register something on my mind, and I was a little boy of 4 and 5 at the time.
How old were you when you first came in contact with St. Patrick's? Because I understand that you joined the choir.
I came to Melbourne with my mum and dad, but my father was only on leave. He was in the army and he was home for a short time. And we came to Melbourne to stay with relatives. And I have a sister still, who came with us. And we have two more children who are now middle-aged people. But they came while they were in Melbourne. So the four of us came to Melbourne. And I went to the local school. And it seems, and I never knew what this meant, but it seems as one of the nuns said, well, I think you've got perfect pitch. And I thought, well, whatever is that?
Well, there is a time in the Catholic Church where you might have been castrated to keep the purity of your voice, so your timing was good.
you're spot on, but I can assure you I didn't belong to that period. And I went into a way of life at St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is where I was situated in this extraordinary choir being formed by a most remarkable musician, Dr. Percy Jones. And I learnt the art of music in a most, I suppose, sophisticated sort of a way, a cappella music, music from the 16th, 17th century. Absolutely beautiful stuff.
Did your angelic voice propel you into the priesthood? Did you consider other options like becoming a radio announcer?
Well, that was not a highly thought of occupation in those days.
Still isn't, thing.
Oh, I don't know, Philip. I mean, you've earned the praise of multitudes of people for a long time. I remember, by the way, you and I have spoken once before, a long time ago in Melbourne, and it was over matters Aboriginal. You mentioned Aborigines around my little town called Findlay, by the way. There were a group of them, about nine, I think, who lived in a disused cowshed. And the town was not a very big town at all. You'd cross it in 5 minutes and so on. But I got to know them all, and my mother thought it was rather crazy. And they tell wonderful stories. And my mother had one thing about me. She said, look, you do what you want to do. If you get into trouble, don't come near us. You've got to, you must face whatever you decide you're going to do. Now, sometimes I stayed out at night, and I had some wonderful nights listening to stories of long ago and far away around Findlay and across into Neliquin and over as far as the Darling River in New South Wales, of a life and a world that I didn't know that human beings indulged. And I was a boy of five and six going to the school.
But it gave you this lifelong interest,
absolutely,
in Aboriginality, and this interest catches the eye of the Archbishop. And I love this story. He asked you to develop an Aboriginal mass, yes, in 1973. That must have been fraught with a great many cultural and theological difficulties.
Difficulties, challenges, obstacles, everything. I produced one, and it was a world first, I think. A lot of other people made a contribution to it in terms of music, in terms of thoughts that were used in the application of texts. And
You had quite a lot of Aboriginal input, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Well, I went right around Australia twice, staying at the places where there, first of all, were Aborigines of the full descent who lived in the ancient tribal way, rather totally, and used all the metaphor, all of the cultural expressions, dance, songs, the way that they imparted their own traditions from one generation to the next. It was nearly always in dance form.
But you embraced the very culture that the missionaries had done their best to suppress.
Yes, I think so. There were various forms of repression, of course. I think I could see through what they were doing, but they were very caste conscious about their own culture, Western culture, and Christianity was Western culture, which is a lot of rubbish anyway. It's not the truth of the matter, but it's Western Europe that thinks.
Yes, I believe it has something to do with the Middle East and
something like that.
And if Jesus was heading in our direction, he'd probably finish up on Manus Island.
There'd be no probability about it at all, especially if we have the sort of people who run departments in Canberra at the present time.
Well, I think this was a very significant moment for you, for the Aboriginal community, and yes, the church. And I'm going to give you a koala stamp for your efforts. Now, did this early work influence the way you worked with the East Timorese many years later?
So I went to the university and I gained a doctorate in anthropology philosophy in anthropology, and so I was able to call myself an anthropologist. And I think that in fact was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I began to think differently. I began to indulge human affairs in a very different way from what I had been brought up to. At this stage, by the way, I was about 29 or 30, which meant I was beginning to approach middle age. So these were crucial times. But the other thing I ought to say, Philip, is, and I do mention it in the book, that when I was doing all of this over a period of 6 years it took, and I had to spend 3 years up with Aborigines in the far north of the west of the Kimberleys, and learnt a language, lived with them in the bush and so on, I began to realise that the Aboriginal people were beginning to develop their own articulated leadership. And they were doing their own thinking, and they didn't want a white fella like me telling them what they ought to think or how they ought to think or whatever. I meant then I meant that I had to use my anthropology in some other way.
We're discussing, and I should have mentioned this earlier, yeah. Hilton's biographical book, Bonded Through Tragedy, United in Hope, The Catholic Church in East Timor Struggle for Independence, and I made a clumsy attempt to link your early work with the indigenous communities with what yes. you would do in Timor later. But the link is, I think, the fact that you were aware of the importance of preserving and respecting cultures other than your own.
Exactly.
Now, after some time as a parish priest, you're promoted to the position of Vicar General, which, as I dimly understand, is sort of right-hand man to the Archbishop, Frank Little. Once again, I remember, Frank, did you enjoy that?
I don't know how to answer that question. I can't say I enjoyed it. I regarded it as a challenge. It was a great learning time. One had to understand something of bureaucracy and the extraordinary complexity of church. I was the sort of second man in the diocese, picking up the bits and pieces after the Archbishop walked past.
Well, some of the bits and pieces, of course, are very problematic because the cases of abuse were starting to appear.
No, not yet. Not yet they weren't.
I thought that Frank did take an interest in this, but thought that paedophile priests could be cured.
It was beginning to appear in the sense that there were occasionally priests who had their girlfriends or got drunk or theft, and there was this, it was not called paedophilia, it was called child abuse. And I could remember not very much about it. I had the chance to be able to help one man who really was rather crazy on all of this, and eventually I persuaded him to resign from active ministry. He came from outside Australia, and I said, go home. Now, the Archbishop was away overseas with a brother bishop. When he came back, I told him all about it. I reported it all to him, what I had done. And the interesting thing, I had spent time talking with police of some little section that dealt with this type of problem, and they were very good. One was a man, one was a woman, if I remember correctly, and they were very helpful. Anyway, I tidied that up, but then one day the Archbishop got me into his room. We lived in the same house in Kew, and he said to me, now, I don't want you to handle any of these cases anymore. When they come to you, or if you find out about them, you report to me, and then that's it. You do nothing more. Now, to get to the point that you were making, I think in the first instance, if I read him rightly, and I'm not sure whether I did or not, he didn't know what to do. It wasn't that he was frightened about it, but he couldn't believe that the priest would do this sort of thing for it, first of all. And he only spoke to me obliquely about it from time to time over a period of 6 years or so.
Let's move the saga on, because yes. the story is immense and yes. time is short. So let's jump into the future. Indonesia invaded East Timor when?
In 1975, in December 1975. And it was a bloodthirsty event. It was absolutely cruel. And Australia took not a great deal of notice about it, by the way. The Prime Minister was Gough Whitlam, and he had not a great deal of time for East Timor. He was to prove himself to be a rather poor neighbour a little later on when the man who was in charge of the church in East Timor a little bit later, a fellow called Martinez da Costa Lopes, came to Australia to ask if he could have food for his people because so many of them were starving. And Gough Whitlam called him a liar publicly and told him to get out.
The church, of course, had always played a critical role in East Timor, but it changed after the invasion. Explain the nature of the relationship with the Portuguese government.
Right. Before the time of the Portuguese government, most of the East Timorese were not Catholics. The prime Christian body in the country was the Catholic Church, but it was, I think, about a third of the population who lived around the big cities and the villages. The people, most of the population, who lived out in the countryside, were animists, which was a little bit below the ground level on pretty well everything. Wonderful.
And that's
people.
The same right across the region. It's also true of Bali, which is notionally Hindu,
yes,
but is profoundly animist.
Yes, exactly. And even the Catholic part, I might add, just so that the two of us can know what we're talking about, even the Catholic part has its little room for animist spirits and practices in various places around the countryside anyway.
That's why you're the most successful multinational corporation in history.
There you go. There you go. And I think you're right. We could talk about that forever too. But the sudden splurge of East Timorese becoming Catholics from 1975 on was as much as anything anti-Indonesian, as I would understand it. Whether it's the truth of the matter, I really don't know, but I did listen to lots and lots of people about all of this.
So was the Timorese Catholic Church a branch of the Catholic Church of Indonesia, or was it striving to get a bit of distance?
No, it had relationships, organisational relationships with the Indonesian Church, but the East Timorese Catholic Church was more Portuguese than anything, and it still is. One looks around and I could swear that I'm in a country part of Portugal.
What about the Vatican? What did they want their people in East Timor to do?
The first thing that I would have to say, they would never tell you what they want to do. So you have to do some guessing. Can I give you an instance of one? That Martinez da Costa Lopes, who was not a bishop, but he was what we call an apostolic administrator, doing all the work without the being a bishop. A great man, and he was an East Timorese man. And he ran the church in the beginning of the occupation with the Indonesians and did very well. It was very brave. He lost his way sometimes in terms of policy and so on. But the time came when he started to become friendly with the opposition fighters, the Fretilin, that was fighting against the Indonesians in the countryside and keeping up the hopes and the aspirations of the people to become free.
There wouldn't ever have been a possibility of independence down the track without Fretilin.
I think I would agree with you on that. But anyway, this man eventually began to become a little more friendly and open with the Fretilin people. Now, the word was around that a lot of the Fretilin people were communist. And some of them were. I know some of them. They're communists, and they're good old communists. You take your hat off to them. And I have got to know some of them over the years.
Gosh, hearing you say that, Santa Maria is turning in his grave.
Well, I was just about to help you understand that he got turned in his grave, all right, because he was the one that started up building a public opinion back here in this country against Martinez da Costa Lopes because he was pro-communist or tending to go pro-communist. Now, Martínez de Costa López, according to the history books, he resigned. And he came into Australia, and Australians treated him very badly. Whitlam was the Prime Minister. And he went back to Portugal. And I followed his tracks. He was dead by the time I was interested. He died in absolute poverty. He was a great friend to José Ramos Horta, who regards him as a great national hero. And so I began to study the writings that had been made about him, the sort of things that he'd done. And I'd wondered about all of this, that the Rome would sack him, so that he would resign. So I happened to be in Dili this time, and there was an Australian bishop with the bishop in Dili, Carlos Felipe Bello, and myself, and the papal nuncio was coming, and he was an American. And he came into the place, the villa where Bello lived, and he saw them all, said hello to the three of them. And one of the bishops, well, thought he was terribly, terribly important, and I was not terribly, terribly important. We won't mention his name, but he's dead and gone anyway. And he said to me, "Oh, Hilton, you're here. Come with me for a walk. I want to walk with you." And the other three wondered what was going on. We walked down the beach for about three quarters of an hour, and he kept on asking me, "What do you think about this? What do you think about that? What do you think about the people over here? What do you think about the fighting over there?" And I gave what I thought was an honest view of what things were and how the pressure was beginning to affect Carlos Bello and other clergy and so on. And when we got back towards the house of Bello, I said to the papal nuncio, "Now, I've answered about 30 or 40 questions of yours, and you've got a big brief. I would like you to answer one question for me." And he said, "Oh, what is it?" And I said, "Martínez de Costa López, you weren't here when he was eventually got rid of, but was he sacked or did he resign?" And this fellow looked at me, then looked out to sea. It was getting dark, and then he looked back at me and he said, "Do you really want to know?" And I said, "That's why I asked." He said, "Well, as a matter of fact, he was sacked."
But let's look at the politics here. The Vatican's concerned about the relationship between Christianity and Islam in Indonesia. They don't want to upset the Indonesian Catholic Church. There's a whole lot of things going on. And I learned from you, and I didn't realise this, that there are more Catholics in Indonesia than there are in Australia. So the whole area is quite fraught.
Exactly. You're dead right. And the point about all that, you put your finger on it, I'm not sure that you realise it, that what the Vatican, all of the time that I had anything to do with them and with the top echelon of church members in East Timor itself, was that the Vatican was interested in any harm that might be done to their relationship with the Indonesian government and the Catholic Church in Indonesia. And therefore, anything that happened in East Timor had to play second role. Now, I don't like that sort of reasoning because it goes quite against, or it did for me anyway, and it still does, some basic principles about who is what, who is where in all of this sort of thing.
But, Hilton, let's face it, you're a terrible old lefty. Look, there's so much in this book. There's so much in this book. We've just given a hint of its contents. One of the things I love about it is that Hilton keeps travel diaries and he writes them in Latin to confuse the Indonesians.
Well, anything that I thought was of state interest, policy, or somebody had done this, somebody had done that, I always put it in Latin because I knew the Indonesians wouldn't understand it. They wouldn't even know that it was Latin. So, and I did that. I had piles and piles. Ever since I've been young, I had this habit of writing down who I met, what we talked about, the situation. And I got all this from my anthropology what I should put into a report that I would remember that will be reasonably factual.
Well, I'm delighted to tell the listener that Bonded Through Tragedy, United in Hope is not written in Latin, and it's a terrific story, and I suggest that you rush out and buy at least one copy.
Yes.
Hilton Deacon, Catholic bishop and author of Bonded Through Tragedy, United Through Hope. It's a memoir written by, with the help of Jim and Therese Dorser, and the book is published by Garrett Publishing. Good on you, Hilton. Blessings upon you. And this is Ellie Nell on RN.